Today on Family Talk.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Family Talk. I'm your host, Dr. James Dobson. And just a little under 2 weeks ago, I was in Washington, D.C. as Donald J. Trump was sworn in as our 45th president. Whether you support this man or not, it was a marvelous day as America celebrated the peaceful transfer of power from one president to the next. I stood there in the rain and thanked God for the inauguration of yet another president. It was my sixth such event, beginning with Ronald Reagan's celebration in 1981. Almost 9 years ago, in 2008, we were on a very different campaign trail. At that time, Ravi Zacharias spoke at a ministry event, and in his message, he talked about the importance of a leader and the need to pray for him. Now, more than ever, we need to remember those powerful words, and so I'm pleased to bring them to you again. Ravi Zacharias is a theologian, an apologist, and an author, and that's just a thumbnail sketch of his accomplishments. He literally travels around the world because the Lord has opened many, many doors for him and allowed him to carry the gospel to some of the darkest regions of our planet. Ravi has earned the respect of leaders around the world, and especially in Middle Eastern countries where most of us would fear to tread. And everywhere he goes, he stands solidly for biblical truth, as you'll hear in this message. Well, I don't want you to miss a minute of this program, so we'll go ahead and listen now to Ravi Zacharias on today's edition of Family Talk. I think you're going to like this.
Some years ago, when Billy Graham was hosting that great event globally from San Juan in Puerto Rico, he'd invited many of us to come and share in that event and speak. And I remember the first day arriving, it's a true story. I always hate to tell some of these stories that are taped because somebody involved is going to hear it. But this actually happened. We were sitting around having a cup of coffee, and there was Cliff Barrows and Franklin Graham, and we're all sitting having fun meeting these great personalities. And Henry Holley, who was Billy Graham's front man for many, many years overseas, lives in Atlanta. Henry dipped into his jacket pocket and took out some pieces of paper, and he says, "Gentlemen, I've been traveling around the world, and I've picked up this article, which is the best article on memory I've ever read. How to remember. This is the best thing I've ever read, and I brought it for all of you." And he gave one to the one, so on, one to so on, so on, so on, so. By the time he came down to me, I was sitting on his right, he said, "Ravi, I'm awfully sorry. I've run out of them, but I'll get one to you tomorrow." I said, "It's okay, Henry. When you picked my wife and me up from the airport yesterday, you already gave me one." Leighton Ford took his out of his jacket and said, "Henry, you can have it back. It doesn't work." Which of us has not had the memory lapse? Forgotten. Minutes after you're introduced to a person, you say, "Now, what was that name again? You know, where did I meet this person?" And we laugh and joke about memory because sometimes it is funny. But then those dark years can sometimes suddenly come when it's a serious problem. And forgetfulness now is not just a momentary thing, but you have lost the context for everything. One of my very dear friends who helped me found our own ministry, when his wife lapsed into the early stages of Alzheimer's, I remember him telling me, and some of you know him, he sat across the table with tears in his eyes, and he said, "She thinks I'm a stranger in the home. Where is that man? Who's that man?" So, you know, there's a lighter side to it. There's a darker side to it. And what I want to talk to you about tonight, ladies and gentlemen, in these dark days, is about God and remembrance. What does it mean to remember? What is it that God really wants us to remember? This is a passage I want to read for you, because if we forget the injunctions of these words here, we will remember wrong, and we will misremember, and we will put together the wrong details, and the story may be fantastic, but it'll become a wrong story. And I want to read for you the entirety of a chapter, and if you don't have your Bibles, that's all right. I'd like to read it for you, but please hear this very carefully and allow me to read this to you, because it is a story of the crossing over of the Jordan and what it is God said to his people then. And I think we need to learn from those very words. Early in the morning, Joshua and all the Israelites set out from Shittim and went to Jordan, where they camped before crossing over. And that chapter goes all the way to the leading of the crossing, to begin with chapter 4. When the whole nation had finished crossing the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, "Choose 12 men from among the people, one from each tribe, and tell them to take up 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, from right where the priest stood, to carry them over with you, and put them down at the place where you stay tonight." So Joshua called together the 12 men he had appointed from the Israelites, one from each tribe, and said to them, "Go over before the ark of the Lord your God into the middle of the Jordan. Each one of you is to take up a stone on his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of the Israelites, to serve as a sign among you. In the future, when your children ask you, 'What do these stones mean?' tell them that the flow of the Jordan was cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. When it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the river were cut off. These stones are to be a memorial to the people of Israel forever." So the Israelites did as Joshua commanded them. They took 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, according to the number of the tribes of the Israelites, as the Lord had told Joshua. And they carried them over with them to the camp, where they put them down. Joshua set up the 12 stones that had been in the middle of the Jordan at the spot where the priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant had stood. And they are there to this day. Now the priests who carried the Ark remain standing in the middle of the Jordan until everything the Lord had commanded Joshua was done by the people, just as Moses had directed Joshua. The people hurried over, and as soon as all of them had crossed the Ark of the Lord and the priests came to the other side, while the people watched, the men of Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh crossed over armed in front of the Israelites, as Moses had directed them. About 40,000 armed for battle crossed over before the Lord to the plains of Jericho for war. That day, the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they revered him all the days of his life, just as they had revered Moses. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "Command the priests carrying the Ark of the Testimony to come up out of the Jordan." So Joshua commanded the priests, "Come up out of the Jordan." And the priests came up out of the river carrying the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. No sooner had they set their feet on the dry ground than the waters of the Jordan returned to their place and ran at flood stage as before. On the 10th day of the first month, the people went up from the Jordan and camped at Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. And Joshua set up at Gilgal the 12 stones they had taken out of the Jordan. He said to the Israelites, "In the future, when your descendants ask their fathers, 'What do these stones mean?' tell them, 'Israel crossed the Jordan on the day on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the Jordan before you until you had crossed over. The Lord your God did to the Jordan just what he had done to the Red Sea when he dried it up before us until we had crossed over. He did this so that all the peoples of the earth might know that the hand of the Lord is powerful, so that you might always fear the Lord your God.'" Powerful stuff. When Abraham Lincoln gave his second inaugural address, there were only about 700 some words in it, 797 or something like that. 14 times he invoked the name of God in that address. Today, if a president were to invoke it once, he'd run the risk of the hostility and the rancor of the media. We've forgotten. We've forgotten what framed this nation. We've forgotten the ideas that made a nation like America possible. I've said it in Eastern countries, I've said it in university audiences, and I've asked them to challenge me if they object. No other worldview but the Judeo-Christian worldview could have justified the formation of a nation like this. It's not pantheistic. It's not Islamic. Only the Judeo-Christian worldview would have made the precepts of a nation like this possible. That's not to say it is a Christian nation. I'm just saying the possibility was made because of the Judeo-Christian faith that made such a nation even conceivable. And as I speak to you tonight, I want to talk to you on God's idea of remembrance. You see, the only thing worse than nostalgia is amnesia. And if you forget at a very great price. So let me take you step by step from the passage that we just studied. The first thing that God reminds us is of two inestimable realities that brought that nation into being. The first inestimable reality is the leader. This is something that we had dared forget. Leadership is an extremely difficult thing. It's an extremely hazardous thing. It's an extremely painful thing. It's an extremely lonely calling. And so when the Bible pauses in Holy Writ to tell us that this historic moment has taken place for a nation that is being born, and the Bible pauses to tell us that day God placed Joshua in reverence before their eyes, in the esteem that he'd also placed Moses, it tells you that leadership is key in the eyes of God, and he expects us to respect and esteem our leaders who've paid the price to bring us to a certain point. A young corporal once came to Winston Churchill and said to him, "I want you to know I am a self-made man." Churchill looked at him and said, "Young man, I want you to know you have just relieved God of a very solemn responsibility." We don't stand in midair. We stand on the shoulders of those who've led and those who've sacrificed and paid with their lives. I can say this both personally and I can say this from the impact of leaders upon my life. I don't think leaders could ever go fully public on the heartaches that they've lived with alone. You never know. Many times, my wife will tell you, you feel like saying, "Spare me this. I don't need this. I don't want to be at the helm here. I don't want to be the captain of this ship. I don't want to carry this on my shoulders." Why does every heartache and something so tragic have to be borne by me in so many ways at the end of the day? And then you weep that night through and say, "God, help me." Well, before the Iraq War, we were in the White House. Actually, it may have been Jim and Shelley when we were with you at the earlier National Day of Prayer. I remember chatting with President Bush just for about 3 or 4 minutes. And as I was shaking hands with him, and I said to him, "Mr. President, I just want you to know we'll be praying for you. What a tough responsibility you have." And I remember him saying, he said, "It was a cliffhanger, wasn't it?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Please pray for me. Please pray for me. I don't know what lies ahead, what God has in mind for me, but I will need your prayers." I remember after speaking the second time at the prayer breakfast at the United Nations, the president of the UN said, "Would you come up to my room, please?" Unabashedly said that. He said, "Please pray for me. I really need to be prayed for." And almost any leader you meet today will tell you that they find after a little while, as the knees quiver and the ankles are unsteady, I'm speaking metaphorically, they will say, "Please pray for me." Do you realize when General Eisenhower had to determine the crossing on D-Day, he had 25 minutes in which to make that decision? Because the weather was closing in, and the great general wondered what to do. History was hanging on the balance, and he decided to make the step. And when 10,000 lives were lost within a matter of a few hours, how do you think he felt? But great leaders are given those shoulders, and as lonely as it gets in private, they are made of the kind of stuff for which God has wired them and put them together, and it is imperative that we realize how critical that role is. But if you look back on what fells them, what makes them stumble, Solomon, the untamed passions of a gifted man, Rehoboam, wanton power in a weak man, Jeroboam, the unteachable temperament of a privileged man. Untamed passions of a gifted man, wanton power in a weak man, unteachable temperament in a privileged man. And the nation got divided and the nation fell. I think of the moment, you know, think, just pause for a moment in history of this nation that we were talking about, Israel. David is in battle and he's thirsty and he wants to have something very comforting to him. And he cries out, "Oh, that I had a drink of water from my own well in Bethlehem." It was a nostalgic moment for him. He wanted it so badly. The Philistines were already in there. And three of his boldest soldiers overheard him in a cloak and dagger operation, went undercover, got that water from the well in Bethlehem, put it into a pitcher and came back and went over to David and said, "David, here's a drink of water for you. And guess where it's from?" He said, "Where?" He said, "From your well in Bethlehem." He said, "How did you guys get there?" He said, "That's all right, David. We love you. We cherish you. This is for you." He was about to drink it. He said, "No. No." And he put it onto the ground. He said, "I cannot enjoy the privilege of my comfort while I'm risking the sacred lives of some of my choicest men." And he poured the water onto the ground. Do you know, all of Old Testament history would have been different if he'd reacted this with the same principle when he set eyes upon Bathsheba? Do you realize the temptations that come the way of a leader? The seductions, the allurements, all of these things. And so, ladies and gentlemen, I challenge you tonight, pray for your leaders, esteem them, thank God for giving them the strength and the courage. My wife and I were the guests of the Crown Prince of Jordan. He is the last surviving heir to the throne in Iraq. He's a man in his senior years, the cousin of the former King Hussein of Jordan. We were having a cup of tea with him just a few months ago in Amman. And I looked at him and I said, "Prince Raad, what do you think is the most critical need of our time right now here in this part of the world?" He said, "Youth and leadership. Leaders who will lead with wisdom and youth who will know whom to trust and whom to follow." In two words, he captured the essence of our need: youth and leadership. We were talking at the table here, Bill and I, we were chatting about what people are really looking for. They are looking for leaders with integrity. They are looking for leaders who will be honorable. They are looking for leaders whom they can believe. I remember the night I finished defending the faith at the University of Iowa, 1,500 in attendance with faculty and all. It was a long 3-hour evening. And God did marvelous things that night in the midst of that hostile audience. I walked away exhausted. Next morning, I picked up my bags. The hosts of the meetings were driving me to the airport, and one of them said, "You know, I brought my neighbor who's a very prominent doctor in this city. She never goes to church. She cannot stand religion. She agreed to come because this was being held at the university campus here. And she never said anything after the whole meeting. Just before I dropped her off at the driveway, my wife and I looked at her and I said, 'Can I ask you a question? Please at least give me one line. What did you think of what happened tonight, what you heard tonight?'" She had one line. She said, "Very, very powerful. Very, very powerful. I wonder what he's like in his private life." That's all she had to say. "Very, very powerful. I wonder what he's like in his private life." An hour of defense of the Christian faith. All that was done was hanging on one peg. Was it real in your private life? And so I'm asking you, is your commitment to Christ real in your private life? Pray for your leaders that it'll be real in our private lives, and we will not just lead for the sake of leading. Esteem the leader that God has given, because it's not an easy role. But then he leads us to the next thing. and that is this: he commends the people for all that they had done and how they had crossed over. Do you know, when David was facing a battle at one time, there were 600 soldiers that he started off with, and only 200 could remain. The rest of them got exhausted along the way and tired along the way. And David said, "You go home and get some rest. We'll fight this thing out." And this handful of men won the battle, and when they conquered it, the boys who'd gone out to fight started distributing the booty. And David said, No. This is not the way it's going to go. Listen to what the scripture says. "No, my brothers, you must not do that with what the Lord has given to us. He has protected us and handed over to us the forces that came against us. Who will listen to what you say? The share of the man who stayed with the supplies is to be the same as that of him who went down to battle. All will share alike." David made this a statute and an ordinance for Israel from that day to this. You are part of the reason this ministry has succeeded. It's not just the leadership. The leadership could never do this without those of you who, with anonymity, have done what you have done. Those of you who've given, those of you who've prayed, those of you who've sacrificed, those of you who believed in the vision of this ministry, you are worthy of an equal portion of the reward that God is giving, not just to the leader, he is giving it to you as well. And I want to thank you. I want to thank you because this is what has made the gospel possible going out of North America. Do you know there's not too many parts of the world that'll have gatherings like this to come and think of how to do more and how to give more and how to support more? Not too many parts of the world that'll do it. We are living off the bequest of the Judeo-Christian faith that has taught us to give and to care. I think, you know, last year, to my own shame and embarrassment, I was on the road for 240 days. Hope I never do it again. Main reason I did it, it's the time in history, the Middle East is in turmoil. I've been invited by some of the highest officers of the land there to come and sit down one and one and chat, and so I've given. I just did too much. Who will ever know the price that my wife has paid? Or the children have paid? And frankly, if I had to do it all over again, I'd do it differently. Because you go in with the tug of the moment and forget that there are other cries and other hurts that also need to be attended to. Billy Graham has said it again and again and again. If he had to do it again, he'd do it differently. And one of the things he would do is give time to his own family and the needs that are there when the children are young. You do it with very noble intent, but then when the years go by like that, you say to yourself, you know, I didn't realize it was going to be like a whirlwind come and gone. And so, those of you who've stood by the stuff, I want to honor you tonight. God wants us to remember you. David made it a statute in the land that you will be honored by God because you did it with no recognition and no frontline glory. You did it because of the cause that you considered to be greater than yourself.
Weren't those insightful and very challenging perspectives from Ravi Zacharias here on Family Talk? I'm your host, Dr. James Dobson, and I'm sure you'll want to be with us next time as we continue this important message from Ravi. In the meantime, if you'd like to listen again, you can do so online at drjamesdobson.org. Or if you'd like to hear more from Dr. Zacharias, his website, rzim.org, is a great place to start. On it, you'll find a link to his latest book, Jesus Among Secular Gods, The Countercultural Claims of Christ, and links to Ravi's radio programs, Let My People Think and Just Thinking, and many other rich resources to help you better defend the foundations of the Christian faith. We'll include a link to that page on our website at drjamesdobson.org. And while you're online, would you consider how you could support the work of Family Talk? If you can send along a financial gift of any size to encourage us and to enable us to continue this important work of strengthening families, we'd be very grateful. You can also send your donations to 540 Elkton Drive, E-L-K-T-O-N, 540 Elkton Drive, Colorado Springs, Colorado, 80907. We'd love to hear from you, and be sure to come back next time when we'll continue this outstanding presentation from Ravi Zacharias right here on Family Talk.
Family Talk is not associated with Focus on the Family.